Ladies and gentlemen, ladies and gentlemen, two things are going to happen now, but they're going to happen differently to the way we planned it. For this conference, we hadn't, because we were in a chapel with a big organ, we thought we'd have an organ piece, a fanfare, written for the conference, and that has indeed been done. And the plan was for the organ piece to be written as the Archbishop came through the main entrance to the chapel. He's not feeling terribly well today, but he is here in the room right next to me. And so we are going to change the plan slightly, and that Matthew Goldsworthy, one of the old boys of this school, has kindly agreed to play the fanfare. I'm going to ask you to remain seated while he plays it. It's a 3-minute piece, and then as soon as that's finished, the Archbishop will come out, and I invite you to stand and welcome him when he comes out. Thank you, Matthew.
Thank you. You'll please be seated. This is a true story. Last year in April, I was standing in Vernon Wood's office, and we decided on the theme, and I said to Vernon, wouldn't it be fantastic if we could get Archbishop Desmond Tutu to open the conference. He agreed with me. We'd no sooner finished speaking than the telephone rang in his office. And it was my PA, Wendy, on the phone. And she said to me, "Guy, I've got Archbishop Desmond Tutu on the phone. He'd like to speak to you." I said, "You're surely joking." She said, "No, I'm not." And with that, the Archbishop was put through to me, and he asked me for a favor. And his favor was very easy to fulfill. I said to him, "Archbishop, while I've got you on the line, I've got a favor of you." I said to him, in July next year, in 2015, we are hosting the International Boys Schools Coalition. And I explained the theme to him, and I said to him, "There's no person on earth more suited to opening our conference." He laughed in his inimitable way at me, and he said, "Put it in my diary, phone my secretary." I don't think the Archbishop realized that this last weekend, over a year later, he'd be celebrating his 60th wedding anniversary, and that he would be... And of course, little known to him, a whole lot of arrangements have been happening behind the scenes, including a special ceremony in the St. George's Cathedral last week and on Saturday in Soweto in Johannesburg. But the Archbishop is a man of his word. He's here today. And ladies and gentlemen, please welcome Archbishop Emeritus Desmond Tutu to address us. Thank you.
Host, Mr. Pearson, headmaster of this wonderful, wonderful school, and the president of the International Boys Schools Coalition, and the headmaster of Eton, Tony Little, and the convener of this conference, Mr. Vernon Wood, ladies and gentlemen, fellow teachers, sisters and brothers, thank you so very, very much for your warm welcome. I think God is smart, because when people say all the kinds of things the headmaster has been saying, you are supposed to be blushing. But then... No, nobody notices when I'm blushing. I did want to say a big thank you too for the prelude, that the organ prelude that we had, which I gather was specially composed for this occasion by Grant McLaughlin, and the organist is an old bishop's boy, now an organ scholar in Trinity College, Oxford, Matthew Goldsworthy. I think both of them deserve another round of applause. I am at that age when I am going to fetch something in the next room. And I know this. And I get up and go to the next room and blow me. Now, what the heck have I come to do here? But I had a classmate of mine, a fellow South African. We sat next to each other at King's London, and he said, "You know, it's not as bad as you go up a stairway, and sort of midway up, you stop and you say, 'Was I going up or going down?'" So a very special welcome to you, our guests from overseas. Welcome to Africa. Welcome to the mother continent. Scientists say that our very earliest ancestors, this is where they originated before fanning across the world. Isn't it wonderful when you think of how we are so frequently at each other's throats on the basis of race? I think they must be rolling in the aisles in heaven when they discover that God has this incredible sense of humor, that we are all Africans, you know. So, welcome home. Thank you to those with the powers to decide these things for choosing Cape Town as the venue for this, the 22nd annual gathering of the International Boys School Coalition. We like to think we live in one of the most beautiful cities in the world, with some pretty splendid schools. I must also thank you for inviting an elderly priest to speak at such an important gathering. Yes, in getting from my seat to the microphone, I just might have huffed and puffed like the wolf in the Three Little Pigs. But my decrepitude holds certain advantages. You can heckle me as much as you like, I won't be able to hear you. I like to tell people that I'm no longer as young as I look, though this is certainly not everyone's view. Some time ago, quite a few years ago, we were deeply honored when a community in the Netherlands decided to rename a 400-year-old school after me. Now, that's not the point of the story. Because in any case, they have subsequently come to their senses and renamed the school after someone else. The point is that on that occasion, when they were celebrating the 400th anniversary of the school, a little girl came up to me and said, "Were you here when the school started?" And that was quite a few years ago, several years ago, when I was still relatively handsome and sprightly. I didn't intend to become a priest. I really wanted to study medicine. I battled through polio and TB as a child and was profoundly moved by the compassion and professional diligence of those who cared for me. After completing my schooling, I applied to study medicine and I was accepted at the Wits Medical School, but couldn't afford the fees. My father was a teacher, and I then followed in his footsteps. It was a difficult time in South Africa. In 1948, the National Party's electoral campaign for the introduction of a formal system of racial segregation and prejudice called apartheid struck a chord with the majority of white voters. By the early 1950s, just as I was settling into my teaching career, the nationalist government introduced what it called the Bantu Education Act, which provided for a separate and dumbed-down syllabus for black children, who were effectively ordered to teach our children less, to prepare them for lives of servitude, knowing just enough English and Afrikaans to understand the instructions of their white bosses and madams. And they said this just so blatantly and openly. The impact was devastating. Until then, it was possible for dedicated teachers to overcome poor facilities and inadequate resources with which they worked to produce excellent students. I was in a high school for 7 years and went to a science laboratory in that whole time only twice. Now, had we been totally honest in the final exam, where they asked, when you perform such and such an experiment, what do you observe? We should have replied, nothing. But we regurgitated what our teachers had told us would have been the case. We really had fantastic teachers who made you believe that the sky was the limit and that we shouldn't want to use as an excuse the fact of the conditions under which we were being taught. when I started high school, many of our classes were not in classrooms, regular conventional classrooms. When I started high school, we had four classes in a church building, one class in each corner. No desks. You sat on the benches in the church hall, and when you had to write, you knelt behind the bench, and that was your, as to a desktop. And sometimes your teacher was not so engaging, and you found that it was much better listening to the teacher in that other corner. So, when Bantu education was introduced, my wife and I, both of us teachers, decided that we were going to retire, or at least resign from teaching. And Leah went off to train as a nurse. And I hadn't got many options. Thank God the bishop thought that I might just have a calling to the priesthood. And I went to study for the priesthood. It was the beginning of an unexpected journey. I have been very, very fortunate. I have been fortunate to be supported by the very strong group of people on whose shoulders I have stood. Fortunate for the opportunities to walk briefly with Madiba Nelson Mandela, to cross the threshold from oppression to democracy, to witness the extraordinary therapeutic power of forgiveness, to contribute to healing some of the pain of the past. You're in Cape Town, and you'll probably go and walk on the Grand Parade. That is where Nelson Mandela gave his first address as a free man in 1990 from the balcony of the City Hall. And I had the incredible, really incredible privilege of introducing him later in 1994 as our first democratically elected president. And I whispered into God's ear, I said, God, I don't mind if I die now. This is just so unbelievable. I have been blessed to meet people from many places, of many cultures. Pink, brown, copper, khaki, yellow. Male, female, transgender, heterosexual, bisexual, lesbian, Christian, Muslim, Jew, Buddhist, Taoist, animist, Tamil, atheist, Americans, Europeans, Afro-Asians, Australasians, you name them. Rich and poor, tall and short, straight haired and curly locked, Afrikaners call them Gruskop, all of whom, without exception, were born in innocence for goodness and love. All of whom want to live dignified, comfortable, and secure lives. All of whom want to provide for their children, who hope their children and grandchildren will one day be better off than themselves. Us. That's the us that Flesh Gordon represented against the alien invaders in the old days, and that Arnold Schwarzenegger represented before he became governor of California. Us, humanity, regardless of our postal addresses or what clothes we wear, you know, incredibly, we are members of one family, the human family, God's family. We are made for interdependence. There's a term you will probably have heard or will hear, which we use in Southern Africa to describe our relationship to each other. Ubuntu. A person with Ubuntu is open and available to others, affirming of others, and does not feel threatened by the abilities of others. We're made for each other. We have the self-assurance that comes from knowing that we belong to a greater whole, and are diminished when others are humiliated or diminished, when others are tortured or oppressed. Ubuntu speaks about our interconnectedness. You can't be human all by your solitary self. We think of ourselves far too frequently as individuals, separated from one another, whereas we are connected, and what we do affects the whole world. When we do well, it spreads out. It is for the whole of humanity. When we have this quality, Ubuntu, we acknowledge people for who they are in all their diversity and integrity, with their conscientiously held beliefs. We walk reverently on their holy ground, taking off our shoes metaphorically and literally. We are known for generosity, for compassion, for sharing, for fairness, for justice. Nelson Mandela epitomized Ubuntu. He endured terrible hardship and pain, sacrificing family life, professional career and freedom, yet he did not allow his personal circumstances to get the better of him, to embitter him, to entitle him. He reached out to former political enemies and oppressors as newfound friends, believing all were entitled to a point of view and giving new meaning to the notion of magnanimity. He did not crow over his party's electoral triumph. He listened, accepted criticism, and was willing to apologize for his mistakes. He eschewed personal aggrandizement, believing it was far more important to acknowledge others, to build others, to build for others. But the broad-minded likes of Nelson Mandela, Martin Luther King Jr., Mahatma Gandhi are exceptions to the rule. Most of our leaders over the past few thousand years have treated those they perceived as others like dirt. We live in a world that is dominated by greed. We have allowed the interests of capital to outweigh the interests of human beings and our earth. We continue to allow the search for prosperity, not justice or equity, to dominate our interests. Our appetite to take out and create markets to consume any and everything of perceivable value, to extract every precious stone, every ounce of metal, every drop of oil, every tuna in the ocean, every rhinoceros in the bush. This is insatiable and unfettered by moral or ethical considerations. Remember, we are God carriers, all made for each other, for interdependence. But we subvert the innate goodness within us and worship money instead of the living God. We need a new approach to leadership, a more considerate, tolerant, and compassionate approach. I very firmly believe we should increasingly look to women to lead us in a better direction. Men shouldn't feel threatened or diminished. Benefits of having more women at the helm of our countries, corporations, associations, and organizations will accrue to all and to the world. As teachers in a radically connected global village, we have particular responsibilities to instill in our charges a reverence for others, all others. There are no superiors, no inferiors, just us with our hopes, dreams, strengths, and vulnerabilities. As teachers of boys, we have added responsibilities to contribute to unraveling a few thousand years worth of male chauvinism, misogyny, and gender discrimination. To develop a new cadre of boys more inclined towards considering the welfare of and the effect of their actions on others, more inclined towards improving their arguments rather than raising their voices, more inclined to spending time with their families, more inclined to share. Us oldies don't feel too proud about the state of the world we are bequeathing to our children, girls and boys. We can't feel proud of the nature we have degraded, the species we have lost, the dirt we have created, or the global warming precipice on which we now stand. We can't feel proud that we have failed to resolve the family crisis in the Holy Land, or of the consequences of our failure for global insecurity, for terrorism in America, Europe, Asia, and Africa. We can't feel proud of the massive gulf in living standards between rich and poor. We hang our heads in shame when we read of the disposal of food during surpluses in some areas to maintain high prices, while elsewhere children are malnourished. We can't feel proud that many people die preventable deaths because they don't have access to medical care, to clean water. And we can't feel proud of our collective failure to hold our leaders to account for military excesses, crimes against their people, for pollution or financial impropriety. But we are not without hope. We know that people working together achieve righteous goals, create an unstoppable force. Working together, we make the impossible possible. If we could send people to the moon, defeat apartheid, break down the Berlin Wall, and elect a black man as president of the United States, surely we can argue that the sky is the limit. There are no limitations besides those we impose on ourselves. We live in a finite space with finite resources, but infinite possibilities. We have access to unprecedented amounts of information. If we want more, it is available at the click of a mouse. We have invented technologies our parents couldn't have dreamed of in healthcare, food production, communication, transportation, renewable energy production. Our challenge is to harness these developments for the benefit of all. To acknowledge the biological role of survival of the fittest in natural selection, while unequivocally discarding the dictum as a rationale for bullying and unfairness. To understand that each little bit of good we do matters. It matters that we don't drive a gas-guzzling car. It matters that we recycle our garbage. It matters that we greet people respectfully, that we recognize their humanity and care about their dignity. Each of these acts is in itself both a blessing to others and an expression of our own self-worth. When we put all of them together, we can move mountains. It begins with us. You know the story of the boy who was sitting on the beach throwing starfish washed up on the beach back into the sea. Thousands and thousands of starfish, and each wave washed up a few dozen more. An adult came past and said, "What are you doing?" And he said, "I'm throwing the starfish back into the sea." And he said, "Just look at me, how many there are." And the young boy said, "For this starfish, it is important." Imagine how many starfishes we could save if we all put our minds to it. I have great faith in the youth. I have had the good fortune to meet all kinds of important people over the past 15 years since my retirement. I've met royalty, heads of state, sport and Hollywood stars. You might have noted I'm a chronic name dropper. But almost without exception, It is the young people I have encountered who have impressed me most. I'm often stunned by the depth and clarity of their understanding and by their courage to confront the challenges they have inherited. I have traveled on something called Semester at Sea 4 times now around the world. Those young people just blow your mind. They dream, and I say to them, go on dreaming. Go on being idealistic. Don't allow oldies like us to affect you with our cynicism. Dream that poverty can become history. Some of them do dress a bit strangely, and their taste in music is generally appalling, but they are at a major advantage. Their hearts and minds are generally uncluttered by the anxieties of the accumulation of resources that afflicts older people. They understand the transforming technological communication-rich world around them with greater clarity than the likes of my generation. I say to them, dream. Dream God's dream that this, our world, will be a better world. Dream. Dream. Go on being idealistic. We are in good hands. God bless you.
Ladies and gentlemen, I'm sure I speak for every one of us here today in saying that we are incredibly humbled. Archbishop, your humility, your humor, your compassion, your willingness to share your own life story with us, your message of hope, your message of inspiration and wisdom will be remembered by each of us here forever. We thank you for honoring us with your presence and for opening our 22nd IBSC conference. Thank you very much.
I must give you one more wave and we are gone.